Hello, and welcome to Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry Podcast with me, your host, Lily Ehrman. Happy Earth Month. Even though in the Learning from Nature community, we celebrate Earth Month every month. We are starting to feel the beginning of spring here in Colorado, where leaves are returning to trees, flowers are popping up, and it's finally getting warmer. That's definitely worth celebrating. This episode is maybe one of my favorites so far. We get to dig deep into the world of bees, wasps, and why honeycomb is really the poster child of biomimicry with Dr. Clint Pennock, who's done some incredible foundational collaborative research at the intersection of biology and ecology and engineering. If you've done any reading about biomimicry, you've probably come across designs that include that hexagonal shape. But why is this shape actually useful, or what about it makes it amazing? Dr. Clint Pennock is an assistant professor at Kennesaw State University, where he studies the evolution and ecology of social insects. For the last 7 years, he has studied the ants of New York City to better understand how urbanization impacts biodiversity in both positive and negative ways. Besides studying what we can learn about insects, his work is also interested in what we can learn from them. This has led to his recent work on how honeycomb produced by bees and wasps can inspire new 3D printing designs, as well as research on microsculpting patterns of ants that may improve abrasion resistance. His work in bio-inspired design has been supported through collaborations with a diverse mix of engineers and industrial designers, as well as funding from sources that include NASA and Google. Let's hop on in.
So, Dr. Clint Pennock, please introduce yourself. What's your current position and research focus?
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor at Kennesaw State University. That's in the Atlanta metro area. And it's a great place for me to be because a lot of my research focuses on urban ecology. So I study how urbanization impacts biodiversity, both in negative ways, but sometimes positive ways. And then I also study what we can learn from that diversity. And then that's where biomimicry comes in. So I work mostly with insects, primarily ants and bees. And I'm interested in studying different traits that that these species possess that we can learn from and then look back at how it can improve our own manufacturing or science or technology.
There's so much interesting stuff. I'm super stoked to dive into this with you. But I first want to start off with how you first heard about and got interested in the topic of biomimicry.
Yeah, it's sort of an accident. I think, you know, when I talk about the biomimicry work I do, it feels like something that I never intentionally did. It just kind of followed me and I couldn't get away from it. But maybe that's a testament to, you know, how cool biomimicry is. So the way that I got into it was that when I was a graduate student at Arizona State University, studying ants, I was doing research on ants. The architecture and design program had developed an interest in biomimicry, and they wanted to have someone teach it to their students. Mm. And they came to graduate students like myself. So there was a range of us who got tapped, and I got to, you know, walk across campus and go to the design and architecture building and talk about biology to students who came from totally different backgrounds than I do in terms of, you know, their thinking, the way they look at nature was totally different. The way that they were trying to apply it was, you know, not something that I was doing. I was just studying basic biology and the evolution of ants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here we have students who are, looking into functional aspects of their biology and then try to actually build products based on them. So that's how I got into it. I was basically a biomimicry instructor working at ASU, and I thought it was really cool. I learned a ton from that process. I a lot of visual skills and stuff that I use in my work today, even with data visualizations and presentations, are things that I picked up by, you know, just learning from these students who have a background in visual communication. And that's kind of where I thought I would end. So I finished my PhD. It had nothing to do with biomimicry. And I got a postdoc at NC State University, where I was working on a big climate change experiment environment. And I thought, you know, that's it. I'm working in ecology, climate change. I started doing urban ecology work. I didn't expect ever to go back to biomimicry. But like I said, it just keeps happening. So I met, you know, an architecture professor at NC State who was like, hey, let's like, you know, let's teach a biomimicry course here. So I did one there. And then we just kept noticing cool things about insects that I thought people should know about and probably have functional significance. And so that's kind of snowballed into a number of projects in my lab that focus on biomimicry now.
And this is exactly why I've started this new series in my podcast, because I want to highlight this work that's being done in biology and ecology or whatever. But biomimics are super interested in function and strategy and nature. And they need to collaborate with and work with biologists who are doing that research and understand how nature works in order to accurately mimic nature. So that's what we're going to be doing today. And I'm going to get into it really quick with you here with this new series that I have is about function and the function of one of like the functions that some of your papers have focused on, specifically the one about honeycomb. I'm really interested in. Can you explain how honeycomb has optimized shape and can manage compression? So the functions here are optimize shape and manage compression. I'd like to hear kind of your description of like that paper and what came out of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, to back up a little bit, I'll start with how this project started in the first place. And so I was working at Arizona State University in the Biomimicry Center and was getting to interact with, you know, some really cool scientists outside of my field who work in engineering and physics and places like that. And an engineer came to the center and he worked on 3D printing and had been studying honeycomb at this point, I think for, you know, several years and been doing work on it. And he didn't really know if anything he was doing was biomimicry or if it could be, but he was interested in coming to the center and seeing what a biologist might have to say about some of his work. And when I first met this engineer, his name is Dhruv Bhatte. And when Dhruv came in and started talking about honeycomb, I was like, you know, this is cool. It's interesting to see an engineer interested in this, but what could we possibly learn about honeycomb? Like it's, I think honeycomb, I describe it as the put a bird on it of biomimicry. It's like every biomimicry project is just like, well, let's throw some hexagons in there. And like, that's biomimicry.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the hexagon, it's so cool. It's this thing like, it's a naturally thing that's built by bees that looks like something an engineer would build. That's what I think is so fascinating about. You can go back, like, you know, imagine being a human thousands and thousands of years ago and like cracking open a bee nest and just seeing like, oh my gosh, these things build this extremely regular geometric structure. Like it must have been mind-blowing, especially back then. I mean, it's still, I think, somewhat mind-blowing to us today. But yeah, when Dhruv came to me and was interested in honeycomb, I thought, you know, okay, I'd like to meet and see, like, maybe there's some other things we could explore. But I didn't really think that there was much left to probe with honeycomb because people had been studying it for literally 2000 years.
Yeah.
And so it goes back to your question about the function of shape in the hexagon in nature. And there was this guy, he was actually a Roman general. His name was Marcus Terentius Varro. And, you know, at one point in his life, he led an army against Julius Caesar or maybe Augustus Caesar, one of the Caesars. He led an army against one of the Caesars, lost, was defeated. But Caesar spared his life and knew that he was really a good thinker in terms of agriculture. And so he spent the rest of his life, you know, running his farm and then wrote this book on agriculture, where this has, you know, all this detailed information of Roman knowledge about agriculture. And in that, he was a beekeeper. So he wrote about bees. And he speculated about why bees build using the hexagon. And his conclusion was that the hexagon was the most efficient shape to divide space into equal areas using the least amount of material. And at the time, there's only three regular shapes that make perfect tessellations. So it's the square, the regular triangle, and then the hexagon. Those are the only three options. Like if you try to put octagons together, there's spaces in between them or anything else like that. And so over time, you know, people, there wasn't a mathematical proof for that. But people generally accepted this as one of the most plausible reasons. It's called the honeycomb conjecture. So it had its own name. And there were some various proofs that went into it that said, yes, the hexagon does seem to be a more efficient shape than the square or the triangle. But they didn't look at any other types of shapes that might form hexagons that are irregular as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was something like 2000 years later that a mathematician, like in the early 2000s, his name was Thomas Hale. He tried to prove once and for all the honeycomb conjecture, and like sure enough, he did it and found that yes, indeed, the hexagon is this super shape. It's the most efficient way to divide space into equal area. It's, you know, most likely why bees use the honeycomb for their nests. And it's also why it's had so much success in engineering applications, because it's super lightweight.
Yeah.
It could absorb shock and do all these other things.
Yeah. And I tried to explain this actually. So I made a TikTok about the honeycomb shape, and a lot of it was based off of your paper, which I was like super stoked about. I was like, we need to talk about this more. Because it's such a popular shape and people love it in the design realm, in biomimicry. But when we like are asked about it to explain why it is, or why it's, you know, efficient, why it's strong, we fall short. And that's where I think doing this deep research with folks like you and, Dhruv, and like getting folks involved to collaborate is really important, because you ask questions you wouldn't normally ask. It brings me to this other question I had, and maybe if we're willing to get into this a little bit too, you mentioned like why, or that it is optimized and then it does offer this really efficient way to divide space. How does it optimize shape and how does it manage compression?
Yeah. So here's where the biologist part of me comes out, is that I don't know the math. Like I could not explain it to you. And this is what the great thing about biomimicry is, that I don't necessarily have to know the math.
Right.
Dhruv and the other people know the math. And thankfully, you know, it's been proven that by Thomas Hales that it is this most efficient shape for dividing up space. You know, one thing is it's probably kind of the closest shape to a circle that can form these tessellations. So there's probably something there that links back to why the hexagon is more efficient than other shapes. But for whatever reason, it turns out to be that way. And it's held up. It's not just using the least amount of material to divide up space, but it does have these shock absorption properties. So that's why it's used in a lot of engineering applications, especially in aerospace design, where mm-hmm. weight is a major factor. And so I didn't know this before I met Dhruv, but I've learned now that like basically everything in an airplane is filled with honeycomb. Mm-hmm. And so like the fuselage is wrapped in what are called honeycomb sandwich panels. So it's just two flat pieces of metal with honeycomb in between them. The same sandwich panels wrap the wings. And even when you go and you lift up that little door to put your overhead luggage in the bin, that door is filled with honeycomb. So basically, honeycomb has permeated all aspects of an airplane. It's also commonly used in rockets and other things in the aerospace industry. And it's because it has this property that has a very high strength to weight ratio. It's very strong given its weight. And it just goes back to the nature of the hexagon itself being this efficient shape that uses very little material to divide up space. And so it's crush resistant. It can be quite stiff relative to its weight. And it can also absorb. It's also used regularly in kind of shock absorbing structures, because when it can crush and absorb a lot of that energy. And so that's why Dhruv was working on it in the first place, is because it was already known that honeycomb and that the hexagon mm-hmm. in general is this highly efficient shape for dividing space. And when he came for me, that's kind of where I thought it was going to end. I was like, well, you guys already know this. This Roman scholar knew this 2000 years ago. So, you know, me as a biologist, I just thought like, well, okay, that's probably the end of the story. Like you kind of have everything you need. But where our project got interesting was, of course, I was wrong. We didn't know everything about the honeycomb. And how it started, I found out that Dhruv, even though he had, you know, become this expert on honeycomb and engineering applications, had never actually seen honeycomb built by bees. So I said, you know what, oh, wow. I'll come by your lab. I'll bring some comb out of one of our hives and we'll have a conversation and see where it goes. And that's how this started. So I went down to his lab with a frame of honeycomb, and we sat down and we looked at, you know, he showed me, he specializes in 3D printing metals. So they have this huge, crazy room size 3D printer that makes these very regular hexagon structures that are 3D printed out of metal. They also use nylon and other things with some of their other printers. But one of the things that we noticed is that when engineers make honeycomb, it's perfect. So all of the cells are the same size. All of the walls are the same thickness. And then when those walls come together for each shell, they have really sharp angles. So mm-hmm. they're kind of these perfect hexagons laid out in a panel. When we looked at the bees, the bee honeycomb is still surprisingly regular. So their cells, they make them in two sizes. Generally, they make a worker cell that's a little bit smaller than the drone cell, which the drones are the males of the colony, and they're a little bit larger. So there is some size variation within the comb, but it's strikingly regular. They build it. They build relatively similar size cells, generally in a very uniform pattern. Though there's some cool work that's shown variation of that recently. But what we noticed that they don't do that engineers were doing is that they don't put sharp corners on their cells.
Right.
And we thought, you know, I mean, so if you look at honeycomb made by bees, instead of having these sharp corners, they have a little bit of rounding. They're not like these perfect circles inside the cell, but they have a little bit of material packed into the corner. And we thought, you know, maybe there's some functional significance to that. And so that's where our project started.
And that is a great segue, because this idea of what you're talking about, from my understanding, it's the corner radius. And so can you explain a little bit more of the relationship, or what you found that is the corner radius in relation to the cell diameter or the cell thickness?
Yeah, exactly. So we call this rounding in the corner radius, and that's basically the radius of the circle that would be inscribed in that rounding. And so the corner radius can vary from zero, which basically is a sharp corner, up to one when we correct for cell size, which would mean that they're building a perfect circle inside the hexagon cell.
And that would be like more paper wasp nest kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, so paper wasps, they also build hexagons, and generally they have pretty sharp corners. They still have some corner rounding, okay. And it varies among species. So we measure that among a bunch of species and find variation. But yeah, if you think of a paper wasp nest, they have a much sharper corner. But when you look at honeybee nests, they have some more of that rounding in the corner. And we kind of thought, you know, when you look at bees, maybe there's two explanations for this. Maybe the simplest explanation is that maybe bees are just bad at building sharp corners. They're bees. They don't have hands or tools like we do. They're using their mouths to basically chew up wax. They produce the wax themselves. So they secrete it from glands on the underside of their abdomen, and they wipe up these wax scales with their legs, and then they work them with their mouth, and they pack them into the corners. And that's kind of how they construct these combs. And so one idea was that maybe just bees, they can't build sharp corners. Like maybe if they wanted to, they would, because then they could save whatever material is getting stuck in there, and that there's no functional significance of it at all. And that's something that can happen in biology. Evolution yeah. is not a perfect process. There's all kinds of inefficiencies when you look out into the natural world. So that was one idea, you know, that we started with is, you know, we don't know if that there is a function of this corner rounding. Mm-hmm. But the alternative hypothesis is that maybe the bees know something we don't, and that there is a function of packing the corner with wax and making it rounded. And again, as a biologist, you know, people like myself have been looking at bees and working with comb for many, many years. But changing corner rounding is not something that's easy for us to do. I can't go to my honeybee colonies and say, hey, can you build some comb and don't put that little rounding thing in there so we can see if there's a difference? Like the bees aren't going to listen to me. But when you work across disciplines and you have someone like Dhruv, who's a 3D printing engineer, it's very easy to then talk to Dhruv and say, hey, let's see if we can build some comb On the 3D printer, and some of it we add corner rounding and some of it we leave with sharp corners. And then we test its strength and its stiffness and all these other parameters. So that's exactly what we did. Dhruv went out and he had a student print out a series of different panels that varied from really sharp cornered hexagons all the way up to perfectly rounded hexagons. We threw them on a hydraulic press and crushed them and then measured a bunch of aspects of their strength. And you know, sure enough, what we found is that adding a little bit of rounding to the corners dramatically improves the stiffness and the strength to weight ratio of this material. And so this was a case where, you know, it really took basically 10 minutes of looking at a frame of BCOM to come up with a biomimetic application that could impact an entire industry, the aerospace industry, where this is never done. They never put this rounding in the corner in honeycomb. But we found basically if you add a little bit of that, you can use less material elsewhere and build, you know, lighter airplanes, lighter rockets that are more fuel efficient, that are more material efficient. So it ties into sustainability in some ways too.
That's incredible. I'd love to kind of get at that a little bit more and have you, if you're able to, explain this NASA project and how it kind of fed in from this research and or how it just relates to the research that was done in this paper and like what findings you got from that and how you're applying it or how they're applying it in that sector.
Yeah. So when we made this discovery, this came about pretty quickly. Like I said, it wasn't actually that hard to do once you had, you know, the right people together, some people who like myself who work on bees and someone who has these 3D printing skills. So we were able to write up a proposal to NASA, who's obviously interested in these questions because they're looking at building rockets and space travel and all this stuff. And so they funded us to explore this further. And the idea was that we knew that corner rounding improves stiffness, but we were wondering how you could optimize that. Mm-hmm. So there's these programs that engineers use, and one of the major ones is called ANSYS. And so you can basically design a structure on ANSYS. And then there's, I'm going to simplify this again. I'm a biologist, not an engineer.
No, but I'm from happy my for the simplification.
From my perspective, basically you can design something. You can say, okay, we need to fill it with some sort of stiff structure, and you can push a button and it'll fill it with honeycomb, basically. And so that's kind of what already existed. So you could design a bridge and you could be like, oh, some honeycomb needs to go here, and you could click a button. And the goal of our proposal was to figure out, you know, after you decide that you want to fill a part with honeycomb, is there another button you could press that would say, let's optimize that honeycomb. And so to basically make it the lightest weight for meeting one of our minimum structural needs are by controlling a couple of things that we look at the cell level. So the cell of honeycomb is one of those individual hexagons. And so the variables we were looking at are just how big the cell is. So we call that cell diameter, just how wide they are, how thick the walls are, because you can vary how thick the walls are. And we see that variation when we look at paper wasp nests that are quite thin. But then when you look at honeybee wax comb, it's much thicker. And then the last one was adding that corner rounding. So we basically wrote a proposal where we said, we're going to study, we're going to develop a model basically to test all of these different combinations of cell size, cell thickness, the corner rounding, and then look at how that can vary depending what material you're using. So if you're using aluminum or nylon or steel. And that was like the very engineering side of it. And then I was like, I also want to use this as an opportunity to figure out like what bees and wasps do. So another part of that project was that we had funding in there to actually travel to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, which has one of the largest collections of wasp nests of any museum on Earth. And so they have this room in the back that we were able to go into, and it was just filled with hundreds of different, basically wasp nests, paper wasp nests, wasps that build with mud, combinations of paper and mud, and all these crazy different structures. And so we went there, and then we're able to measure the nest of 70 different species and measure all these characteristics. So we looked at how wasps are adjusting these different characteristics when their cell size is generally determined by their body size. So large wasps have to build honeycomb with big hexagons. Small wasps can build cells with small hexagons. And so then we measured all these traits, how much corner rounding there was, the wall thickness, and then the diameter of the cells. And we did this for wasps. We also did it with honeybees. And we've also done it now with relatives of honeybees, so other members of the genus Apis. But some of them are called like giant honeybees that build these massive individual combs that are just outside on the branch of a tree. In Thailand, that's where we've been working. Whoa. And then there's also dwarf bees, which also build their nests. They're very different from the European honeybee, but they build their nest on tree branches, but they're really tiny, and they hang from tree branches as well. So we're still in the process of measuring some of those. It's been difficult to get our hands on some of those specimens in Thailand. But so we've added these to this data set that looks across all these wasp and bee species. And the idea is to, you know, one, try to create this optimization to try to figure out what is the best honeycomb you could put into a design on the engineering side. And then my question is, are bees and wasps actually doing this? Has evolution shaped their behavior so that they're producing more efficient honeycomb when they build nests?
Right. So interesting. And there's so many application opportunities here. And I think that's it's a good segue, because kind of the next phase of my questions relate to, I feel like you've done a lot of really incredible collaborative research, which is so important for biomimicry. A biologist on their own can't get there. An engineer on their own has a hard time getting there. We need these efforts where there's, you know, engineers and biologists and mathematicians like working on this together. And at the end of your honeycomb publication, there's kind of mention that more research is needed and kind of these nuanced features of the honeycomb structure and even other biological models. What do you see from your perspective as a biologist as like next steps for examining different structures or materials and including like load stress or managing compression in nature?
Yeah, I think, you know, thank you for mentioning the role of collaboration in this, because it's ended up becoming a bigger part of the project than I imagined as well. And so I recently spoke as part of a symposium and then wrote a paper about the role of building collaborations between biologists and people like engineers who are applying these concepts, because it actually doesn't happen that much. So in biomimicry, biologists are kind of a rare species. Most bio-inspired projects typically are engineers that look at something in nature. They might read some published literature that biologists have worked on previously, but rather than bringing a biologist onto the team, they tend to just go it alone. Mm-hmm. And so I make an argument, and largely based on some of this work that's come out of our work with Honeycomb, that adding biologists onto a team and then integrating biology research alongside engineering research can actually lead to more interesting innovations than, you know, just biologists working on our own or just engineers working on our own. And that's exactly how it happened with our honeycomb project. So like I said, our goal when we started this and we got our first round of funding from NASA was basically just to figure out like what's the optimum corner radius to put into a honeycomb if you're trying to apply it to some sort of aerospace application. And so when the engineers started working on this, they were focused on stiffness. That's one of the main measures they were looking at. Mm-hmm. And they developed a model where they could test, you know, across any material, across cells of any size, what is the best corner radius to put in to minimize the amount of material but maximize the stiffness. And what they found was actually quite boring. It was what they found was that the maximum corner radius was always best. So no matter how big of a cell, or no matter how thick the walls were, or no matter if you're building it with steel or nylon or wax, or for that matter, you should always make cells that are basically have a circle inscribed in the middle of them. So basically you put the maximum corner radius in every corner, and that is going to give you the highest level of stiffness using the least amount of material. And so this is something that you don't even need a button for, right? Like there's nothing that they could integrate into Ansys or sell to another company or do anything with, because the answer was so simple that you should just make all your cells rounded.
Right.
And so at the same time, like I said, I was, you know, traveling up to New York and we were measuring these nests and we were looking at honeybees nests from, you know, all over the world. And what we were finding was, you know, of course, bees and wasps don't do that. They don't build their cells with a perfectly inscribed circle. And so it goes back again to that original question. Maybe bees don't know what they're doing, right? Maybe they're like, you know, I guess it's beneficial to have some corner rounding in there. But, you know, if they were really smart, they should be putting a full circle in there based on what we found with our models. And that's not what they're doing. That's not what paper wasps do. And even these things that we're building with mud, sometimes they build almost complete circles, but sometimes they don't. And so, you know, we got back and we had a meeting and we were talking about this stuff. And one of Drew's students spoke up and was kind of like, well, you know, this maximizes stiffness. But, you know, do bees care about stiffness? Do they want their nest to be super stiff? What do they care about? And I was like, well, a bee cares about their nest, you know, not falling down. That's the point. They don't want it to break. And they said, oh, because that's not just stiffness. Stiffness can help with that. But the other thing is that it needs to deal with stress. And when there's stress applied to something like honeycomb, what happens is cracks develop, and that's eventually how it's going to break apart and fail. And they said, oh, there's a totally different way thing that we would have to do if we wanted to test how corner radius would affect stress. And so based on that, what happened was this student who's the lead author on the paper that you've mentioned, he went back and developed other models. And that what he found was that unlike the models for stress, or unlike the models for stiffness, rather, the models for stress showed that there was a variation in what would be the optimum corner rounding that should be incorporated. And it depended on how thick the walls were. And so if you're like a paper wasp and you build really, really thin wall structures, adding corner rounding actually increases stress and makes it more likely that your structure will fail. And the reason being is that if you add a little bit of corner rounding, what it does is it transfers the pressure to the thinnest part of the wall. And so they crack in the middle of those walls.
Right.
And so it's actually a bad thing to put corner rounding in those. Like, they're going to fail more easily if they have corner rounding compared to if they don't. But if you go more towards something what a honeybee or some of these wasps that build these really thick walled nests with mud, what we found there was that adding corner rounding distributed the stress. And so in these, instead of cracking in the walls, they tend to crack at the corners where the walls come together. And so if you add corner rounding there, it actually decreases stress and makes the structure stronger overall. And so things like bees and wasps that build with mud should be building more rounded cells. And in fact, that's exactly what they do when we look at that. So then from this, we were able to develop sort of an optimum if you're interested in stress mitigation. And it depends on the ratio of the size of a cell and how thick of its walls are. And then based on that, then you can figure out what the optimum corner rounding is to put in. And what I think is so cool about this is I don't know if we would have gotten there had it not been for the fact that we had engineers working on this project from one side, and then me as a biologist and my biology students working on it from another side, and trying to figure out how these two models could fit together and how, you know, what the engineers were doing could inform our ideas about the evolution of bees and wasps and how they build these structures, and vice versa. And so, I think this is just a really great example of putting together interdisciplinary teams. The project definitely went in places we didn't expect. And that is what I think is so cool about it.
I think this beautifully exemplifies the power of collaboration. And I love that you were able to speak to that so much. And I had a question related to this, but I think I'll sum it up in this instead, like a different angle of this question. But I think a big hurdle for a lot of researchers is the act of finding a collaborative team, finding collaborative funding. It might become, it's becoming more popular, but it's still less available than these kind of more straightforward funding opportunities. And correct me if I'm wrong, but in your experience, like, how do we start these conversations? How do we get this collaborative team in the first place if you're in an academic institution or you're in a very siloed research department?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a challenge that people have been discussing for a long time. And so our project came together because Arizona State decided to create an interdisciplinary biomimicry center with the goal of connecting people across campus. And it works, right? So when you build a center and you have people, staff in that center who are going around talking to people all over campus, working on different things, you kind of can work as a matchmaker and put people together. And so that's how this project came about, right? There was some very intentional initiatives that came from the top of Arizona State with the goal of creating these interdisciplinary collaborations. So I think programs work. Like if you create them, you know, the other thing is when we were at Arizona State, we managed an interdisciplinary grants program that required a biology faculty member and then someone outside of biology to be co-PIs on the project. That helped. NSF has things like that where they have collaborative grants, maybe less so deliberately to create bio-inspired projects. But there are some intentional grants applications that require some form of collaboration. And at least from my side as a biologist, working in biomimicry has opened up funding opportunities that would never have been available to me. And so we get funded by NASA. As a biologist, I never thought I would be funded by NASA or working with engineers there or doing anything like that. And so it's super exciting. And it was interesting, at least from my side, to find that actually NASA had a lot of interest in this. And so they've supported a lot of biomimicry work. And I think it's just because they have the right people there who are interested in this kind of thing. And they see that, you know, maybe if they spend a little bit of money to study the evolution of wasps and bees, it can pay off in really cool ways that people might not initially understand going into a project. But at the end of a project, you see these cool emergent things that happen when you bring people from different disciplines together.
Yeah, it's so true. And like you just explained in this interview, it's like there's all these different people who have different questions and a different understanding of the question and are able to kind of dig deep into these different areas that you normally wouldn't have assumed that's where you wanted to take the research. But that's the power of it.
Yeah. And for me, I would just say it's fun. Like I really enjoy working with people across disciplines. And so I have a lot of interdisciplinary projects, work with computer scientists and physicists and engineers. And so for me, it's just a personal trait. So I think if you're kind of open to these types of collaborations, what I found is that they just happen, right? I have people cold call me regularly who are just interested in maybe doing something with ants, but they're an engineer. They don't know how to keep them.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I think a lot of people let those sit in their inbox without a response. But if you just talk to people and you're interested in this kind of work, I think what I found is the more I do is that the more opportunities there are. Mm.
So before we end this interview, I really want to kind of highlight some of your other work. You've done some really interesting research about social insects and adaptations to climate change. Can you give like a little teaser about this and tell us like where to go to learn more?
Yeah. So that's, you know, at the root, I'm an ecologist and I study global change. So the impacts humans that we're having on natural environments, well, natural and human modified environments. So I worked on a giant climate change experiment as a postdoc where we literally heated the forest for 5 years and then measured all the effects that it had on biodiversity. And we focused mostly on ants because there's a lot of ants there and they're quite diverse. And we found some really cool things about how we can predict the impacts of climate change on biodiversity across the globe, just based on some of these experiments that we ran in the US. I have papers on that you can check out, but it's the Duke and Harvard warming experiment if people want to look it up and see some of the stuff that's come out of that. And then while working on that project, I just got really interested in other ways that humans are affecting the environment, both in positive and negative ways. And, you know, looking a little bit more at the positive side pushed me into work in urban ecology. And, you know, I think a lot of us and me going into this for sure thought that, you know, us building cities and expanding urban developments is only going to be bad news for the planet, that it's only going to be hurting biodiversity. But one of the cool things that my work has found and things that have really changed my opinion on about how humans interact with nature is that that we found that in a lot of cases that if humans are doing things intentionally, we can actually benefit biodiversity mm-hmm. in our cities. So I've been working in New York City for years on their ant communities, and the island of Manhattan actually has higher number of ant species that are residents than the closest protected site outside of the city, for instance, which is kind of fascinating.
I love that.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, no one planned it, but there were people who protected large green spaces inside Manhattan, like Central Park, yeah, and some of the other park systems. And people have managed the habitat in ways that are still benefiting native species, which is really cool. And now, right now, my lab is funded by the USDA to do similar work with bees in cities. And we find similar effects where, when we design gardens and planted spaces around our homes and around businesses, we tend to focus on floral species and things that are great food for bees. And so there's been some studies. I mean, there's certainly negative impacts of cities on biodiversity. And certainly if things are done poorly, you're seeing really negative effects on things like bee diversity. But we actually find with some levels of urbanization, and particularly if people are planting native species or good pollinating species, that we actually can see benefits to bee diversity. There's a lot of, you know, emerging work we have on that in my lab, but we've been working with local urban gardens across the U.S. So we've been working in 10 cities to study the impacts of urbanization on bees, and it's variable. And we're trying to understand, again, more intentional things people can do to support biodiversity in cities.
This is a powerful point too, because I think from the biomimicry perspective, at least, we have, you know, reconnect as an element for biomimicry and emulate and ethos. And exactly like everything you just said speaks to all three of those. Like we're not always a negative impact on the ecosystem. And I think that's an important point to remember as we're designing, as we're connecting with nature, that it's not always these far away, very wild, quote unquote, untouched spaces. Nature is everywhere. We are nature. It's the backyard. It's the pollinator garden you're starting. It's your you know, native plants that you're helping put in the park nearby. And they all have an impact. And it doesn't have to all be bad.
Yeah. And I think, you know, mentioning things like reconnecting with nature and the ethos, I mean, it's where people live today. So across the globe, over half the world's human population, we now live in cities. In the United States, it's much higher. It's like over 70 or 80% of people live in cities. And so this is where people come in contact with nature. So many people, you know, if they're not traveling out to national parks or going on hikes, they still are interacting with nature every day inside cities. And so I think if we can reshift people's perceptions to realize, hey, you are a part of nature, a mm-hmm. city itself is a habitat. And there are cool things here. I mean, we find all kinds of cool different species. We've done work in my lab where we've been looking for antibiotic compounds that ants produce, for example. And we found that the ant that produced the strongest antibiotic from our entire study was living in a stump in my backyard. In downtown Raleigh, North Carolina, when we did it, for example. So there's really cool and important species around. I'm always surprised by different things that we find around our houses and inside our cities. So I think it is a good way to just kind of, you know, help people understand that they are a part of nature, and that even your house can be a habitat if you're looking at it in the right way.
So true. I'm a big advocate for nature is everywhere. We are nature. You know, going on walks around the block, whatever it is, like that gives me hope that like we're deeply connected, even though we are, you know, living in suburbs or the city or whatever, it's everywhere around us.
Yeah,
so totally. My final question for you, Clint, what is giving you hope right now?
I think one thing that gives me hope is just, especially now working on species that were previously maligned. So now a lot of work in my lab, it focuses on ants and bees. And when I used to bring up bees growing up, everyone was like, had a story about, oh, one stung me and it like totally hurt. Mm-hmm. Or I'm worried about someone who's allergic to bees and like, maybe it'll kill them. And there was like a lot of terror that was, when I was growing up, the Africanized bees were spreading throughout the Southern US where I lived. And I literally imagined like swarms of killer bees who were like, you know, trying to hunt down children. That was my perception of bees like growing up. Like I thought they were terrible. And now every time I tell someone I work on bees, it's the response I get is like, oh, thank you. The yeah. bees need help. We have to save the bees. They're so important. And I think just seeing people's perceptions change in such a short time from going about, you know, focusing on bees stinging them and being no good to now, you know, I think there's widespread concern about, you know, insects in our environment, which insects are usually the thing that people are most disgusted by and hate the most. But it's cool to see these really positive changes. And I think, you know, maybe the next frontier is wasp. Like I said, people now love to say that, well, bees are great, but I hate wasp. I'm like, no, wasp also pollinate. They also do really cool things. And we learned how to build, you know, better honeycomb based on wasps that we were investigating. So I think, you know, our ability to change people's perceptions and develop positive perceptions about wildlife is something that gives me hope going forward.
So true. And I feel like what you just said about bees, it's like bees are the gateway insect. They'll open the door potentially for some other insects to be loved and admired by the masses.
Yeah, I try with ants all the time. And ants are working too. Yeah, so
ants are getting there.
Yeah, ants are getting people. I think people are interested in ants and bees too because they're social. But yeah, definitely bees right now are the people.
Are you still selling ant pillows?
Yeah. And so, I don't know if you want me to talk about this much.
Yeah, but,
that's
do it. This is a perfect segue.
Yeah. So, you know, as a scientist who spends a lot of time with insects, staring at them under microscopes, I just realized that very few people understand the diversity of insects that exist, like even on our sidewalks, let alone across the globe. So when, you know, most people I talk to, when you tell them you study ants, like, you know, I'll get questions like, oh, do you study red ants or black ants? And it's like, well, there's more than two types of ants. There's like, you know, over 15,000 species that we've described and plenty more that we haven't even discovered. And when you get them under a microscope, though, like I can understand if you're just looking at them on the sidewalk, they don't look like much. But under a microscope, they have these crazy patterns and these ridges on them. Some have these like golf ball like dimples. They have weird hairs, weird head shapes and all these different things. And I realized, you know, people don't see that. And that's a way to kind of help get people to connect with nature is to just realize like how diverse some of these small organisms are. You know, my two-year-old daughter knows the difference between zebra stripes and leopard print and tigers and all of these different things. But she doesn't see even, well, she might see more because she's my two-year-old, but you know, most kids don't know the difference between, you know, four or five different species of ants that live on the sidewalk outside their house. So I developed this collaboration with a textile designer to create, instead of doing like zebra print and leopard print, we created ant print. So they have really striking patterns on their bodies. Some of them, you know, they have kind of speckled appearances. Some of them have stripes and interesting fingerprint looking like patterns. So this designer created a series of prints that they don't have like actual physical ants on them. It's more like how you would print like a leopard print garment. But instead of leopard print, it's the print of a different ant species. And so we launched this under the brand name Holotype. And we have a shop through Threadless so you can buy pillows and stationery and prints for your wall that are based on these. They came out really cool. It was this really beautiful project. I think there's a lot of success in raising awareness about biodiversity generally. But one of the other sort of secret reasons behind me wanting to do this is because, you know, even though the public, you know, the public hadn't seen a lot of these different patterns, but even scientists like myself, we look at these patterns all the time. We can use them to tell different species apart, but no one knew their function. No one had any clue what these patterns do. And so one of our goals in creating this collaboration through textile design was to take some of that money and then put it into funding an undergraduate student to do some research on the function of these patterns. And so we started there and we've kept going. Now I had a graduate student who just finished his master's thesis focused on this. We've now been digging into, you know, why insects have surface texture patterns on their bodies. And it's just exploded into another kind of project of bio-inspired design in my lab. We, you know, they potentially have aspects that they can control microbes on their bodies. They could be involved in desiccation resistance to some degree. And the thing that we're really interested in now is abrasion resistance. So I have a student who is working right now on studying how these microsculpturing grooves on harvest pressure ants might help them reduce abrasion when they're digging. And this is something that could have applications for sure to human technology. So I think this is a cool, you know, another way to have collaboration that you can collaborate with engineers, but even collaborating with artists and things like that can help you get outside of your bubble and think about things in a different way.
And these prints are so beautiful. Actually, I rock my holotype t-shirt pretty frequently. I have one and I wear it to the climbing gym and everywhere. And I've gotten asked a few times and I get a little happy when I get to explain it to people because yeah, it's like a visual representation of diversity in an area that most people don't think twice about. So it's super special.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so, yeah, we started a project during COVID when all of our labs were shut down that I had students go through a database online of ant portraits, basically headshots of ants. And they went through over 12,000 images and had to classify all the patterns. And so we have a paper coming out probably in the next month or so that's looking at how these patterns evolved and then digs a little bit into the function. And that's what we've been following up on with research in my lab.
This is perfect. I feel like we went full circle.
Yeah, totally.
Thanks so much, Clint. I'll wrap it up here. I really appreciate your time and all the work you're doing. It's just super inspiring. I always get excited to read new papers of yours because I feel like they are, one, a great example of collaboration, but also just a good explanation of how nature works.
Great. Thanks so much, Lily. It was great to catch up.
Okay, so these are the two papers we mentioned in this episode if you want to explore them further, which I encourage since they include a lot of amazing visuals. The honeycomb corner radius related one is called Bio-Inspired Honeycomb Core Design, an experimental study of the role of corner radius, coping, and interface. Another one is Parametric Optimization of Corner Radius in Hexagonal Honeycombs Under In-Plane Compression. You can also look up www.peniclab.com. That's PENICKLAB.com. Thanks so much for tuning in today. As always, I'm very grateful for this community. A little more than a year ago, I decided to finally take the leap and start this podcast. It's been such a rewarding experience and learning journey, and now we are nearly at 10,000 downloads. Thank you for listening, rating, reviewing, and sharing with friends or family. I'm excited to see how it continues to evolve. See you next time.